Hi, welcome to Brian's Spain Domain. This is episode 7 of our long series on the history of Spain. Today is the first of several episodes focusing on the Romans and their presence here and their legacy on this country, which was immense, to say the very least. And we'll start today by looking at how the Romans actually conquered this land known as Hispania. And that was actually comprising both Spain and Portugal. In the last episode, we saw how the Romans and the Carthaginians slugged it out for commercial and territorial dominance of the western half of the Mediterranean. This happened mainly during the Second Punic War. And for 20 years, we're talking 219 to 201 BCE, the two superpowers essentially pummeled each other relentlessly, until only one of them was left standing. And that one, that lone combatant, was Rome. It was the victor, but it was a bloodied and bruised one. It had taken a shellacking from its rival and survived mainly thanks to cool-headedness, shrewdness, smart thinking, and more than anything, perseverance. They took a beating and they just kept coming back. And not even military geniuses of the likes of Hannibal could bring them to their knees. And we also saw the important role, that pivotal role that Spain, as we said, known as Iberia or Hispania back then, played during this conflict that would change the course of Western history. And how did that happen? Well, to begin with, Hannibal and his family, they were from Carthage, but the family, the Barcas, had moved to Spain or to Hispania in 237 BCE, about 20 years before the Second Punic War started. And that helped Carthage take control of much of eastern and especially southeastern Spain. And it was also from these areas that Hannibal would launch his famous campaign. Now, everyone recalls that famous march over the Alps and into what is modern-day Italy. But few know about the Roman response. How did they respond to this? And it's surprising because they were defending on one hand, but on the other hand, they were attacking. So this is what I was talking about, this smart thinking. Rome's presence in Spain actually started in 218, the year after the war began and when Hannibal was invading their territory. And they did that essentially to interrupt and disrupt Hannibal's supply line of just about everything, including manpower. So while Hannibal was wiping out legion after legion in the territory surrounding Rome, the Romans were back in his home territory, in his backyard, basically, doing the same to his people. And many of the tribes and the peoples in Iberia at the time, the Iberians, the Celts, and another group known as the Celtic Iberians, were allied themselves, with both sides, probably a little bit more on the Carthaginian side, but they worked on both sides, depending on who seemed to be winning at the time. Anyway, in 205 BCE, basically around then, the Carthaginians had to leave the peninsula, and the Romans had Hispania to themselves, with no real threat to their control, or so they thought. The immense power vacuum created by the withdrawal of the Carthaginians left Rome as sort of the sole foreign presence in Hispania, as sort of a privileged position. And the Romans liked what they saw. This was a land full of potential, not only as a kind of breadbasket for the empire in terms of olives, cereals, wine, but it also had a ton of precious metals that the Romans very much wanted and lacked back at home. For example, it's been recorded that in 194 BCE, we're talking about 10 years later, Hispania was providing Rome with something like 5,000 pounds of silver, 1,400 pounds of gold, and hundreds of thousands of pieces of coin, mainly silver. And this would be sort of an annual contribution to Rome. And that's why they obviously thought about sticking around. So if the locals, the Iberians and the Celts, thought that once the war was over, the Romans would return home, they had another thing coming to them. And if the Romans thought that these local tribes who, compared to the Carthaginians, seemed like a pack of pushovers. Well, they needed to think twice because it would be another 200 years before the different peoples, the different tribes of this peninsula would finally be forced to give in. And the final strongholds of resistance, the final pockets of resistance, would succumb. And so for the next 2 centuries, you basically had a bit of everything. You had moments of full-scale wars, sieges, revolts, rebellions, civil wars. And then you had some periods of genuine peace. I'm not sure if it was 100% peaceful. It seems like there was always something going on, some kind of freedom fighting, some kind of skirmishing. It just seemed to go on and on. But there were moments when things were quieter. So let's first comment on a couple of main points regarding this period. You see, in reality, Rome initially only controlled the eastern and southern coast of Hispania. They basically took over the land which the Phoenicians, the Greeks, and then later the Carthaginians had settled in previously. And the others rarely bothered to go much further inland. And at first, the Romans did the same. The main difference is that while the Phoenicians and the Greeks, and to a lesser extent the Carthaginians, sort of focused on trade, they had these people as trading partners, so they weren't really interested in occupying so much. The Romans tended to like occupying a lot, and wherever they went, they wanted to impose pretty much their culture, and that's where they began to run into trouble in Hispania. Now, the first thing they did, the Romans, is divide the territory that they had conquered and taken over, this coastline, into two parts, into two provinces. The Citeria province, which went from the northeast, which is Catalonia, all the way down to Murcia, so like the eastern coast of Spain today, and then the Ulterior province, which covered mainly what would be Andalusia. Okay, this was established in 197 BCE. And it was this very year that the locals began to give them a taste of what they could expect for the next 200 years. We're talking about the Iberians. They were the first to sort of rise up. They were also the first, probably the closest in terms of proximity. Many of them were the very same people who had fought side by side with the Romans during the Second Punic War. First came a revolt in Catalonia, which was put down, but with great difficulty. And then in the southern territories, mainly the Turdetanos, they successfully defeated the Romans and were sort of in control in that area for a brief period of time. But then came the famous general named Cato, who was called in and asked to deal with the problem. And after trying to convince them to lay down their arms and avoid a worse fate, he was forced to use the heavy hand of Rome and its military machine. Many of the defeated were sold to slavery, and Cato returned to Rome with an impressive treasure of loot, confirming to the Senate his prediction before he left that the war would pay for itself. This was in 185 BCE. So, as the Romans pushed inland, they encountered more tribes, and the reactions varied. Okay, there were some who surrendered willingly from the beginning and sort of benefited from Rome's foreign policy of making these conquered people sort of citizens, and they received a lot in exchange for their cooperation, we'll put it that way. And then the others, then there were others who sort of put up a fight but surrendered early on, and the Romans were a little bit more benevolent with them, and they received certain benefits. I don't think they were allowed to be citizens yet, but benefited in certain ways. On the other hand, they usually had to pay a sort of tribute to them, an annual amount of money, and probably provide manpower for some of their military operations. And then there were those who held out the longest and basically fought to the death, and they were naturally on the receiving end of the harshest punishments. This often entailed executions or being sold to slavery. Just what sparked these wars was a result of many different situations. A lot of times it was the tribes who preferred to defend their freedom, but other times they were just sort of fed up with some of these governors or generals who were abusing their power as they were far away from Rome and sort of were the local head honcho, and then no one could really tell him what to do. More wars. Well, in 185, in fact, the Lusitanians, we'll get to them in a second. They were partially defeated and reached an agreement, a peace treaty with the Romans. And then a few years later, in 181, there were tribes and towns in what the Romans called Celtiberia, which is somewhere around the Zaragoza, Cuenca, Soria, and Rioja area. They were mainly Celts. They took on the invaders. The Romans detected that these people were actually trying to band together and push them back, especially in the south. And the Romans would need 2 years of some serious fighting to put that one down. And then things sort of calmed down for a while. And the Celtic Iberians in that area had to pay economic compensation yearly, these tributes. They also would provide manpower for the military. They were also prohibited from building walls around the cities, and they had to be careful about the use of their own armed forces. But eventually, the locals sort of got tired of the Roman demands and started to become defiant. In 156 BCE, Rome had sort of managed to take pretty much half of the of Hispania, and had it somewhat under control. But then the resistance began to stiffen quite a bit, as we will see. Not long after, the Lusitanians rose up and took on their oppressors. Lusitania was a region in the western half of the peninsula, sort of the western part of Spain, in a region which is today Extremadura, and mainly Portugal. If the name of the famous ocean liner that was sunk by a German U-boat in World War I should come to mind, well, that's where it gets its name from. And even today, the Spanish use the word luso, L-U-S-O, as another word for an adjective for Portuguese. Well, the Lusitanians were serious fighters, and they were always putting the Romans to the test and making life difficult for them. They were one of those tribes that the Romans really didn't enjoy having to take on. But anyway, who these people are is sort of a debate. Because they're not sure if they were, I guess, basically Iberian or Celtic or another group. Most recently, they're starting to think it was probably Celtic. In any event, this uprising was famous because of its leader, a man named Viriatus, who resisted Roman expansion quite successfully, I might add, for years. His name has become legendary, and his persona has come to symbolize the Spanish resolve to defend their freedom at all cost. Up to that point, the Lusitanos, or the Lusitanians, had been engaging in on-and-off conflicts for years. Several leaders before Viriatus had given the Romans a run for their money, and then the Romans would sort of come back and fight their way back and strike back. So it was sort of going back and forth. And sometimes the Romans would resort to trickery. You see, Rome had an impressive military machine, but it was not always a big fan of fair play. And on occasion, they proposed a peace plan to their enemies, but had a different idea in mind. And in this case, it was one that was suggested by the Roman governor named Galbus. And this sort of entailed the Lusitanos giving up their weapons and meeting to iron things out. I think they also actually were going to break up into three groups. So for some reason, the Lusitanians thought this was a good idea. I don't know why. They put good faith ahead of caution. Why they didn't err on the side of caution and use their common sense is beyond me. But anyway, they came forward, and what happened was that the Romans basically took advantage of the fact that they were unarmed and began to surround them, the different groups, and wipe them out. And if they surrendered, they executed them or they sold them to slavery. It was just a massacre. And it was such an appalling act of underhandedness that even the Roman Senate apparently was disgusted with Galbus. It is also believed that Viriatus was among the few survivors of this treacherous act, And so when he came along a couple of years later and was ready to take the Romans to the cleaners, it's easy to understand what was motivating him. He was really frustrated, he was really angry, and he was out for revenge. What made him stand out from prior leaders is that he was by far the most successful. He headed the rebellion from 149 BCE and kept it going for over 10 years. The Romans never managed to defeat him definitively. In fact, he is said to have only lost one battle against them. One of the keys to his success was avoiding direct open field engagements with the Romans. Some of his predecessors had done that and regretted it. He preferred guerrilla warfare, and it worked very well for him, as it would for many of these Iberian tribes. He was so successful that after many years, the two sides eventually actually reached a peace agreement, from which the Lusitanians were officially declared Roman allies. So that's pretty impressive, okay, for the Romans to say, listen, we're good with you now. If we can't beat you, we're going to join you, or vice versa. But not all Romans were satisfied with this arrangement, and they continued to look for ways to defeat them. But before they could do that, it was basically too late. Instead, Viriathus was assassinated by three lieutenants of his. I think they were from a different tribe, but they were part of his army. And they sneaked in the middle of the night and murdered him while he was asleep. Well, that's how the story goes. The debate concerning this act was who was behind the idea. Had the three suggested it to the Roman general, a man named Linus, in return for monetary compensation, or was it Linus's idea from the beginning? Regardless, the story goes that once the three had committed the deed, they went to collect what was owed to them, only to be told by Linus that Rome doesn't pay traitors, thus getting betrayed by themselves. Some say they were let go and they were ignored. Others say they were executed. But just how true the story is has yet to be determined. Now, with Viriathus out of the way, the Romans managed to keep the Lusitanians in check. Then came the famous Celtic-Iberian Wars and the defense of the city of Numantia, is in Spanish, Numantia. The Celtic-Iberians, as I mentioned before, were this group of people that sort of inhabited the lands around the Ebro River. We're talking about a region sort of north and northeast of Madrid, as I mentioned before, Soria, Rioja, Zaragoza, Cuenca, maybe. These people are called the Celtic Iberians because that's how the Romans described them. But they were probably Celtic more than anything else, though they did have contact, a lot of contact with the Iberians, who had also had contact with the Greeks and the Phoenicians and so on. So that may have made them a little bit different from the rest of the Celts. In any event, Rome had already battled it out with them on two prior occasions. The first one we mentioned was in 181 to 179 BCE. The second one took place in 154 to 152. At both times, the Romans struggled, but they ended up victorious. The third one started in 140 something. It's sort of hard to say when it exactly started. Some people actually relate it to that second war, but it would drag on for years and years and years. As I mentioned before, this conflict is most famous for the siege of a town called Numantia, which is just a few kilometers outside of modern-day Soria, the city of Soria. But it actually started off in another place, not far from the city of Zaragoza, a town which was trying to build a wall on its own, and that was a big no-no according to Roman conditions. So the Romans moved in to deal with the situation, and the population and the troops from that place fled to other parts. Many went to Numantia. Numantia, was known for two reasons: its strategic location and its harsh weather conditions. And I can vouch for both. I went to the archaeological site one time in early December. It was a pretty day, and we were actually having lunch just below where the site is, in a town called Garay. It's maybe a couple of kilometers from the center of Garay, and you don't go that high. But for some reason, the minute you're out on that open plain where the city was, it's crazy, crazy cold and windy. And it's true, you get beautiful views of everything around. I mean, it's all open, and you can see the mountains in the distance. But one thing that made me wonder was who in God's name would want to live there, and why in God's name would anyone sacrifice so much to conquer it? But I guess the Romans were ones who just didn't like people not surrendering to them. And there may have been reasons for that. I mean, one of it may have been as simple as if one city is able to hold out, well, that just might encourage other places to do the same. So, I mean, and it was probably something like that. But anyway, the Romans did try for years and years and years, and they would send general after general to get rid of this city, to make them capitulate. And it would never work. They would try to attack, and the people from Numantia would always just survive and beat them back. Finally, they decided to bring in the big gun of their leadership, Scipio Aemilianus, or Scipio Africanus the Younger. This is the grandson of the Scipio Africanus who beat Hannibal in the end of the Second Punic War. This is his grandson, and he was involved in the Third Punic War and was responsible for the total destruction of Carthage. They just left Carthage in ruins. So he seemed like the perfect guy to bring in and sort of do the same to Numantia. The first thing that Scipio did was try to whip the troops back into shape because they had gotten a reputation for being undisciplined. And Scipio was unwavering in his resolve. I mean, he had marched them to death practically. And they weren't allowed to do anything. He said, if we want disciplined armies, and I'm going to make one out of you. But once he had the army ready, he launched a campaign that culminated in the building of a 3-meter-high wall around the city of Numantia. The circumference was 9 kilometers. What was his plan? Well, basically, he wanted to starve them out, because he was going to cut off all the supply lines, including water, and basically, he would wait and watch as the people of Numantia slowly weakened and slowly died. There were attempts to break through the siege by the people from the Numantians, I guess we call them, Numantinos in Spanish. And one group actually slipped through and fled to nearby cities for help. But basically, no one dared double-cross Scipio unless they were willing to pay a price. For example, in the town called Lutia, which was supposedly about 60 kilometers away, the younger members of the town were like game for joining forces and helping out their brothers who were on the other side of the siege. But the elders of the town were totally against it. They knew better, or at least they thought they knew better. And they actually told Scipio, this is what our predicament is. Can you help us out? So the Roman general arrived with troops, and he took 400 young men from that town. And he cut off the right hand, obviously making them useless as soldiers, as warriors, as they couldn't use their weapons. So Scipio was a no-nonsense guy. In the summer of 133 BCE, the people of Numantia, the Numantinos, finally surrendered, but in a fashion that would recall the Jewish fortress of Masada 200 years later. Basically, at least this is the way the legend goes, they killed themselves instead of letting themselves become captive to the Romans. And the few who survived were sold as slaves. But basically, it was just a mass suicide. There is some debate about that, but that's the story. Numantia earned the admiration of the Romans for its perseverance. And to this day, it has become the symbol of resistance at all cost, a symbol of ancient Spain's fight to the last man. Soria's soccer team, for example, is known as Numancia, not Soria. And a Numantine fight, una pelea or lucha Numantina in, say, sports, describes a heroic, stubborn show of opposition, usually defensive and usually by a weaker side. One curious consequence of the Celtic-Iberian Wars was the impact it would have to this day on the modification of the calendar. Traditionally, the Romans started the year in March, which is when they would assign a consul who would be sort of the general in charge of all the military operations that were assigned for that year, that summer, basically. And they would continue to fight until the fall. And when the winter came, they would stop. and start again the following March. That's where March gets its name from Mars, the god of war. The problem was it would often mean that the military leader would not get to Celta Iberia until June. So any complex campaign which employed sophisticated tactics would be compromised by the limited time they had. So to give their armed forces 2 more months, the Senate decided to make that decision at what they call the calendas of January, which was January 1st. And in other words, New Year's. So our current New Year's, in part, is a consequence of Rome's war with the Celtic Iberians in Spain. So that's sort of an interesting little side note for you. In any event, once Numancia fell, the last major pocket of resistance disappeared, and little by little, Hispania began to reduce its opposition to the Roman invaders. Wars would continue, but not with the same intensity, and probably a little bit less frequently. Ironically, in the final century BCE, the only thing the Romans really had to fear was fear of themselves. This was a period where there was a string of civil wars that tore up Rome as a nation, and it even went into its conquered territories. The first to affect Hispania was the Sertorian Wars. In fact, they were fought almost exclusively in Hispania from 80 to 72 BCE. Quintus Sertorius was a popular Roman leader and general who went to Hispania to break away from the Roman Senate. It's a very long and complex story, but for our purposes, we need to know that he nearly succeeded, especially once he was backed by many of the tribes in Hispania, including the Lusitanians. Using the now familiar guerrilla warfare tactics, he defeated army after army. Finally, Pompey the Great arrived and started to put him in his place. Before Sertorius could actually be completely defeated, he was assassinated under tragic circumstances in the year 72 BCE. I'll actually have to tell you about that on another occasion, because it's an interesting story. Pompey the Great would be involved in another civil war, this time the famous one against the supporters of Julius Caesar. This conflict raged throughout the Mediterranean, but the final battle, Munda, took place in the south of Spain on March 17th, 45 BCE. It would be Caesar's last military engagement, and it would happen 1 year, practically to the day, before he was assassinated in Rome. The exact location of Munda has yet to be determined, but it was somewhere in Andalusia. The final regions to submit to the Romans were the Cantabrians and the Asturians, who used the rugged mountainous terrain on their territory to their advantage. By that time, much of Hispania had now been pacified. A new setup had been established where there were now 3 provinces, Tarraconenses, that was the largest one, which comprised mostly the east and northern parts of the land, Bética, modern Andalusia, in fact the soccer team in Seville, Betis, comes from that, and Lusitania, which we mentioned before, which was the western part of the peninsula. Only the northern mountains of Cantabria remained mainly free of Roman occupation, but the Romans wanted to put an end to everything, and they were getting tired of it, so they launched a major campaign in 26 BCE. In fact, Augustus came in to supervise the operations himself because he was concerned about how long it was taking for the Romans to beat them. 7 years later, in 19 BCE, the job was completed, and unfortunately, the Cantabrians were nearly annihilated. After that, Hispania had finally turned Roman, so to speak. A long period of stability would reign in this part of the empire. We're talking another 400 years, basically. The local tribes would assimilate Roman customs, culture, habits, as well as its language. The ancient pre-Roman peoples, their cities and towns, their culture, and their languages would almost basically disappear until almost hardly anything remained. But not everything. Obviously, there are names that are still, Asturias still exists as a name, as does Cantabria and the Basque country, the Vascones. But aside from these nominal vestiges, it's safe to say that at this point in history, we've reached the end of one age for this land, but obviously the beginning of a new one, the Romanization of Spain. The Romanization of Spain will lay the foundations for much of what Spain is today. And that will be all for today. That was, I thought, was going to be a shorter podcast, but there was a lot to say. But that's enough for today. But anyway, we hope you've enjoyed this podcast from Brian Spain Domain. If you have any questions or comments, please leave them with us. We'd love the feedback. You can follow us on Amazon, Spotify, and Castos. And if you wish to support us, check us out on Patreon. Stay safe, stay well, and hasta pronto.